All right, I have 4 o'clock on my watch. I think I'll get started. It's such a beautiful day. I'm surprised anybody is here, so thank you for coming. My name is Gretchen Bagel. I teach at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. And somebody beforehand, now I can't remember who it was, asked me to explain what I'm doing with this information, how I got interested in this. So here's the brief history on that. I've always been interested in history. Sometimes I teach history. Mostly I teach general humanities now and in honors college. I have a background in museums. I spent 10 years working at a museum in Delaware and a few other museums in Massachusetts and New York. And in my studies, I was looking at the kind of information you would need if you were going to teach people how to be curators of house museums. That was where I started. And when I went to graduate school for my PhD, I happened in on some religious history classes and realized that here was an opportunity to combine my interest in the built environment, the material environments, what scholars call material culture. So how we use objects and the things that people make and use to learn about them, to learn about what they value and what they anticipate for the future, and what sorts of everyday lives they lead. So I was interested in the everyday lives of people and what sort of tasks made up those days. So then I realized that not many people had studied these two things, material culture and religion, and put them together. So that led me to look at primarily religious architecture, but other things like communion silver and religious practices in the home that involve material things. And this current project that I'm working on is, most of my other training was pre-Civil War. I probably know more about colonial New England than any other place or time, which isn't too helpful to me now in Indiana. But when I got to Valparaiso, yesterday my last slide for those of you who were here was a slide of the Valparaiso Chapel, which was built in 1959. And when I got to Valpo about 5 years ago, that first year I taught a small seminar called The American Home, and I had my students do a project on the former president's house at the university that was now an office building, but it was also 1959. This isn't the short version I'm telling you, after all, it's become the long version, but the house was designed by the same architect who did the chaplain. At that time, nothing was really known of him. There was little in the school archives about him. He designed hundreds of churches, and it was hard to even find his name on the internet. So I spent one summer just looking at his buildings, thinking I would do this as a service to my new university community and learn something about the chapel. And in the process, I discovered that there's a really interesting story about what happens to religion in the suburbs after World War II. So it involves some pretty big historical questions about the denominations and the growth of the suburbs and whether the suburbs were good or bad for religion in America. And meanwhile, I realized there are thousands and thousands of these ordinary congregational post-war buildings that nobody's cared about. Many people have, in fact, and still do despise, people who worship in these congregations as well as people who drive by, because they look bland, they look ordinary 1950s buildings, and they're not so workable for the kinds of spiritual and social lives that many congregations lead today. So that led me to a focus on three architects: Charles Stade, who's the architect of our chapel, Ed Sovick, who's a very important Lutheran architect in this period, and one other architect who did not so many church buildings. He also, Ed Dart was his name, a Chicago architect whose last career project before he died an untimely death was Water Tower Place in Chicago, for those of you who are familiar with Chicago. So, and that's a good segue into my topic today. Church buildings, and I should say most architectural historians, people who call themselves that, don't think about these sorts of social and cultural questions. They're interested more in design and how one architect influences another, and are interested in that first moment when a building is new, but not so much in how the building lives after that and how people adapt the building and have to adapt to it, because architecture is very important in shaping our lives. So we can look at church buildings and even what we're building today and realize that as Christians, these buildings are telling the world who we are. It's not just what how those buildings serve us, but it's what they say to the wider world out there. One of the most important considerations when it comes to church building is stewardship. For one thing, stewardship of our financial resources, and many congregations for good reasons have chosen to forego a church building altogether and worship in a house, not invest in property, be able to send their resources to places where they feel greater need. Other congregations have been deeply committed to place and creating something beautiful and ornate and have spent a lot of money on church buildings. Church architecture talks to other church architecture, so you have a conversation within and across denominations and even religions through buildings. And I want to start today by looking at where church architecture is today, by looking at what's happened to these 1950s buildings, because that'll tell us what churches need now that may not be supplied by these buildings. So we'll start with, this is an Ed Sovick church in La Crosse, Wisconsin, St. Paul's Lutheran. And there's a beautiful chapel there that was meant as a quiet, worshipful, meditative space that's now used on Sundays by a local Hispanic group, a local Catholic Hispanic. I think it's a Pentecostal church, actually. And so here's a space that is still a lovely space, but trying to do something that it really wasn't intended to do. And the addition of new kinds of praise music is a challenge for a lot of congregations. Another thing that's happened is the basement has died. Church basements are not desirable spaces generally. And here's an example of one that's used pretty effectively for preschool and after school programs in this is a very lively church in Moorhead, Minnesota. But in new church construction, rarely do you see basements. And part of that is they're underground, they're dark, they start to smell very soon. But also that it's hard to get congregations now to go downstairs after a service or before a service. People don't tend to think, oh, church is over, and make a deliberate decision. Now I will spend 45 minutes talking to my friends in the basement. And we just don't think like that. We're thinking about the next thing that we need to do. So basements are out. Another thing that I've talked to some of you about this week is that partly because of that trend I just said, it's very important to grab people on the way in and the way out of the sanctuary. Just be in their way with the coffee and trip over the coffee machine and the tables and get them to sit and socialize. And so many older churches are trying to find ways to carve out coffee areas, little cafe areas in small narthexes, sometimes just tables shoved against a wall. And here's a case, this is a Westwood Lutheran and Sovick building again in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, where this was an outdoor garden courtyard between the education building and the sanctuary, and they decided to pave it and enclose it, and there's a lot of light there, so it feels a little bit like an outdoor space, and they can hose down the stone on the bottom, but it's basically the social space for the church then. It's a big church, but it has a very small narthex area and no basement that's usable. Now, this is another Sovick church in Onalaska, or I don't know how you pronounce that, anyone from Wisconsin? I'll say Onalaska, Wisconsin, a 1954 building. And this building has had a variety of changes in the last decade that suggest even more things. Here, sorry about the light on that. I photographed an image in a church basement. But you'll see in the original church, this 1950s building, it's for pedestrians. That is the entrance to the church, and it faces the street. So there's the assumption that even in Wisconsin, people will be walking to church on Sunday morning, that the congregation serves that community, and that's the main point of access. So there was a very small narthex there, and then you walked into that space, and to the left you see part of the early education wing. What you see on the right is what I saw two summers ago, and the orientation inside has flipped. So that has been sealed up, that's become the chancel area of the sanctuary, and that's closed off to the street. And there you see the new, that's facing the street now, so people come in through the other side. And they did a really wonderful job flipping that around. I think it looks very natural. And in addition to that, this has been built on the front of that church. So you can see the peak of the roofline behind. That's the entrance to the old sanctuary. And two things here, a large fellowship area and a large covered entrance, which is related to accessibility, which has become an issue for churches as well as for many other public institutions. And inside, it's a kind of open, ordinary space. It works very well. There are tables set up for coffee. There's an open cry room. There you see the old altar in the upper right from the original sanctuary with a flat screen TV on top. And that's another thing that's happening to churches, of course, is having to refit for new media. Well, new churches that are built pay a lot of attention to that, but it's also a problem for these older churches to figure out how to put in video screens if they choose to do that and use media that serves their congregations.
Were those all three one church?
This is one church, these changes.
The three?
The others were different churches before that, the basement.
Yes, but this, okay.
This is all this one church.
Three separate buildings.
No. Yeah,
this one?
This is this building.
Two, three?
This is one building. This is the same building.
Inside.
That's inside.
And this is the new addition.
And that's the other side.
And this is the interior to the new addition.
Are they connected?
Yes, they're all connected. Wow. So it's a thriving congregation, and this wasn't an inexpensive addition, but it solved their needs. There's a lack of architectural coherence, which is often the case with additions like this, but it works. Okay, so these are trends that I've noticed. This is a working list. It doesn't claim to be exclusive or complete, and not all new churches follow all these trends, but these are some things that I've already mentioned. There's a trend towards informality in worship. Someone brought up the idea of what we wear to church the other day, and that's related to so comfortable spaces that tend to be very thin when it comes to any kind of symbolic ornament. You'll see a cross, maybe a stained glass window, but that's not the emphasis. And that has to do with design considerations as well as cost. A second is this growth of the need for a large gathering space. So narthexes in some cases are nearly as big as the sanctuaries in new construction. New seating patterns in the sanctuary were kind of getting back to that auditorium-style church, but also in smaller churches, the emphasis is on flexible space and flexible seating. So more than in the past, people are not choosing pews, but choosing cathedral seating or chairs that can be moved around in different patterns to use the sanctuary for different kinds of worship, for other events, for concerts, and so forth. No basements, I mentioned that. Accessibility, which is an important thing to consider for especially the elder members of the congregation. And this orientation to car travel. That Onalaska church has a huge sea of parking lot out in front of it. And that's how most of us get to church now, by driving. And mega churches have enormous parking lots, in case you've noticed these interstate temples that you drive by.
We're in the midst of a program now, and it's average 2.5 cars per family.
Wow.
On a Sunday morning.
Ooh, really?
2.5.
Wow. I just read some statistic. We'll get to the Willow Creek in a minute here, but apparently if you took all the square footage of Willow Creek, including the parking, and you put it in a building the size of the Empire State Building, it would need to be 171 stories tall. So a lot of square foot that's all spread out in Willow Creek. And a concern for environmental stewardship. That's not affecting everyone. And it's very expensive to do, say, a LEED certified building. That's not generally an option for most congregations. But thinking about the land in, for instance, putting in rain gardens to manage water flow, using environmentally friendly buildings, paying a little bit more for materials that lead to better insulation, that sort of thing, more efficient heating and cooling systems. And another part of this emphasis is on the environment that you'll see, especially in the middle section of these slides, is a desire to be open to the outside, a desire for light-filled spaces. not all, always, but in many, not so much in the case of the heavily media-oriented sanctuaries, because you need it dark in order to use video, but in many of the smaller churches especially.
What about eco-friendly, what about all this parking space, cement or blacktop over? Do you see many trends in more eco-friendly parking?
Parking?
Permeable.
Yeah, we're exploring that in our own church right now and going to do something like that. And that's partly just, we're concerned about our relationships with our neighbors who are who just had a major road come through that's caused water problems, and we're trying to make sure we don't add to that.
Excuse me, you mentioned no basements. If you have the land, is it advisable to have it all on one floor rather than the second floor?
To the accessibility.
It's an accessibility.
It is.
But forgetting the accessibility, but also just for
Land use.
Comfort and the feeling of it?
I think that's what, it's the suburban model. It's not possible in cities generally if you have a smaller lot size. You ask if it's desirable. There's so many perspectives on that. Maybe that's what people are comfortable with because we're not used to going underground. But I'm not sure that's always the best use of space. You have a much bigger footprint if you sprawl out on several acre suburban campus and land that might be used for something else. So it's a good question. Okay, well, I'm going to suggest that the trends in church architecture are predicted by two really important American buildings of about 1980. And one of these is the Crystal Cathedral. This is the first so-called seeker-sensitive church. This is, you all know this from television, I'm sure, but Robert Schuller is Dutch Reformed Christian, RCA, Reformed Church of America, pastor from Michigan. He goes out to Los Angeles. He's very inventive, has services and drive-ins, uses all new media, tries to bring people who are seeking, who are unchurched, into his congregation. And now it's very institutionalized. This is much more institutional and formal than a lot of the mega churches, but it's still there have been some succession problems right now, shall we say. But the architecture is really interesting in a lot of ways. Philip Johnson is a well-known American architect who died recently. And the building itself, well, I'll show you a picture in the interior. The building's from about 1980. The prayer tower is closer to 1990, I think. So there's the inside, and if those of you who were here yesterday thinking about the auditorium church and then the swing back to the divided chancel and a more formal worship space, and here we are again in something that's an audience and an entertainer more than it feels like. And that sounded really disparaging. I don't mean it to be necessarily a bad thing because it works well for many people, but it's a passive kind of congregational experience where you're looking down on a remarkable choir and an extremely fantastic, expensive organ with thousands of other people. And this building cost $17 million in 1980, so it's an expensive building. And it holds about 3,000 people. So really not unusually large by current megachurch standards, but at the time it was very interesting. Exposure to the outside, certainly, but I don't think the idea here is about nature and communion with nature. I think it's more about Hollywood and visibility and California sunshine and kind of excitement and energy that comes with that light. And I have never worshipped here. My dad was there once and he said he couldn't hear because of the waterfall that flows through the center. I don't know if any of you have worshipped there, but
is that a baptismal font, or what is that? Is that water? Is
that's
that actually
water?
That's
the water that flows.
Flows through the center. Yeah. Have you been there?
Yeah. I've been in there once. Not during a service, just to visit.
So it's a landmark work of architecture, as well as in this evolving church movement towards the megachurch. And of course, this is another critical church in that movement. This is the Willow Creek Community Church, a huge complex you're looking at on the upper left. And this is their new sanctuary, I think like 2006, 2007, on the lower right. Now, if you were driving along and you pass this building, is there anything there that would indicate to you that it's a church?
No, it looks like Nike.
And that's by design. These are not buildings with no design. These are buildings that have very carefully considered design. And the philosophy behind this, which is extremely successful, is that there are a lot of people out there who are not attending church, and they don't attend church because they're not comfortable in churches. Where are they comfortable? In secular society, in shopping malls, in libraries.
It looks like a bank up there.
So let's not make the architecture something that prevents people from coming in. Let's build a big space that feels natural. And it's had success. This is the lobby area, and it looks like an airport.
Yeah.
And again, that's by design. This is an exciting place to be, lots of people, lots of things going on. And those of you who know a lot about megachurch practices, there's the Sunday services, and then there are many things that happen in small group that give meaning to the people who choose to worship there. But this is not anything that we saw before in the 20th century in church architecture. And then the interior, this new sanctuary seats 7,200, cost $73 million. It's just enormous. And one of the interesting things here too, which I also noticed in our own building project, is the architect arrives to those first meetings with an acoustical designer. And the acoustical designer is intimately involved with the design of the building because it's about media. And these, in the case of Willow Creek, there are these phenomenal stage productions that involve all sorts of media, and then lots of very engaging, wonderful music throughout the services and at different programs during the week. So it's not, the building isn't designed to be acoustically perfect on its own. We used to, you know, architects had these dimensions that they thought worked well so that when you stood in the pulpit, you could be heard in the back without the help of microphones. And we don't even start there anymore. We start right away thinking a video, microphones, stage lighting, all of those things right from the beginning. So this is a team of architect and acoustical designer working on this building. And there's one of the stage shows. Another thing is that you can watch this service from other places in the building. So I don't know how this is different. I guess if you're there in the coffee shop with people who are part of the congregation, that is different from watching on TV at home. They also distribute the services by satellite to satellite congregations, essentially. It would be convenient if you wanted to push your child back and forth and you couldn't get into that to your sanctuary. So very engaged in contemporary culture, extremely thorough market research, designing these places as well as the worship that goes on inside. This is the Prince of Peace.
Could I ask a question about theology? Did they ever think about that?
The theology, yes. Yeah. And the remarkable thing about the megachurch for me, I'm trying to be an anthropologist, not pass judgments before I talk to people who worship there. And I'm amazed to hear about what kind of transcendent experiences people claim they have in these spaces. That I just can't imagine it. But that's what they feel when they're there. So it's taught me a lot about how I, you know, project my own assumptions onto things like this phenomenon. And the theology is about the reason that they worship all together is because of the excitement of worshiping God together in this tremendously large group. But then they also know that community happens in small groups. That's why they have the balance of the two. So,
I was recently doing a social services summit in a rural area mega church, if you will, in the sense that they are rural and they took over a Safeway. But what was interesting was they were telling me theologically that this was very important. They had a whole staff. Every PowerPoint I did was up on the screens because they're celebrating God's gifts, and everything we do is professional stage production because we're celebrating God, and we want to be happy and wondrous so that we're attractive to other people. So they were very intentional, they were very clearly communicative, and this was a non-secular use of the space, or secular. But it was very intentional on their part that they produce a professional show.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a summit that was a production. There were 3 or 4 microphone people, different PowerPoint people. They had everything come up. The minute I did a sticky card, it flashed up, and it was very important to them. And it was a problem when we needed to center the group around the work they wanted to do, and it wasn't the show. So we needed to take a break from the show to let people do the work they needed to do. And it was predictive, but still disruptive. They're like, oh, you've got to be kidding. Because we're here to do a show and show people that children of God feel good. So that's my experience, was just very directly.
Yeah, I'm just
theology.
There's a book I can recommend that didn't come to the bookstore by the time I got here, but it's called From Meeting House to Mega Church. And it's a wonderful study because it's now about 8 years old, but they're basically architectural historians writing this, but they interviewed a lot of people in 60-something mega churches. And at the time, most of them were in the West, Southwest, and the Southeast. And now there are even a few in New England, which is shocking to me. Having lived in New England, I can't imagine those two cultures together. But I think it's just a phenomenon of the times, and as a historian, I'm just kind of saying, well, we'll see where this goes. You know, do people really want to go to a church that has 10,000 members? I don't want to be baptized in a place like that. You know, how do they handle these more personal moments? Who was telling me that one of these churches just built a separate chapel because, maybe it was Willow Creek, a smaller chapel for weddings and funerals, because that would just feel wrong to do something that intimate in a space like that. Prince of Peace in Burnsville, Minnesota is a church that was initially a post-war congregation, I think, organized in the early 60s, and early on had a ministry that involved using local drive-ins, and this was very community-focused. And their most recent expansion was, number one, taking over an adjacent medical office complex. So thinking really in terms of what's the cheapest, most efficient, best way to expand and find an educational and office space. And then this new sanctuary from about late 90s, I think. So this is just throw this in as a Lutheran example of something that's clearly following that Crystal Cathedral and Willow Creek sensibility. And this is here mostly so that you can see the floor plan. This is an entirely new church, just a community church in Wisconsin. That's the garden variety of the mega church. It's a lot smaller. The sanctuary seats just several hundred people, but it has all the characteristics of a building like this. In the auditorium seating, the large stage, the big video screen that dominates over the chancel area and pulpit and so forth. So this is very popular. If there's one plan type right now that I could say generalize as the most common way of building a church, it's this, and across denominations. It's fairly efficient and inexpensive. And
do you have a cost on this one?
I don't. I'm guessing, just a few years ago, and I haven't visited it in person, I've just been reading about it, and I think it would probably be a couple million.
Are those rooms in the diagram offices, or?
Yeah, office space along the bottom, I believe, classroom space. There's that, see the large narthex or meeting area space there?
But I just wonder if there's less emphasis on Sunday school rooms.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Educational units, that everyone was building an educational unit, and Sunday schools have diminished so much.
They have. That's something that's very interesting to me. I just wrote something about the Sunday schools in the 1950s and 60s and their buildings, which are burdens to congregations now, unless they're being used for something like a preschool. But when you read back through the records, There was one church that I was looking at that had 1,000 children in Sunday school every Sunday. In an education wing with 23 classrooms, they ran 3 sessions of Sunday school. And other churches that had kids in school buses in the parking lot for Sunday school because it was the baby boom. And now it's just different demographics. There are some creative things I hear about too, churches partnering with neighboring institutions and just using their rooms for Sunday school so that they don't have to. The Sunday school rooms are often just used for an hour on Sunday morning, and it's a lot of space to maintain. So it's not very efficient. Multi-purpose rooms tend to be better. But again, notice that large narthex there. And here, this is a new Lutheran church in Nebraska. Or it's an expansion of a Lutheran church, and this is very typical as well. A little bit more design going on here, a little more refined feel to the interior. You see some crosses, some emblems of faith, but it's you get the gist that this is a lot like Willow Creek in many ways. And the video screens here are much more subtle on the sides of the cross up there. Okay, the second building, I said there were 2 buildings from about 1980 that I think predicted what happened after that, and this is the Thorn Crown Chapel in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, or near Eureka Springs, done in 1980 by the architect Faye Jones. Faye Jones, who died not long ago, was a wonderful man who ran the Rural Architecture Studio at the University of Arkansas, and encouraged his students to build things out of natural materials, to respect the environment, to help struggling people build beautiful buildings and so forth. And in this case, there was a retired school teacher who had this property near Eureka Springs and used to hike up to this point and admire the view. And he had an idea that he would, as his retirement project, build this chapel that would be a place for visitors to the springs to stop and meditate. So he got involved in this project that ended up costing him more than he thought. It's relatively inexpensive at $200,000, but most retired school teachers don't have $200,000 sitting around. So he had some help along the way. And what this, it's small, it seats just a few hundred people. It's 24 by 60 feet. I think the height is 40 something feet. But this is very environmentally sensitive. In fact, it was designed so that there's no element in this building that couldn't be carried to the site by 2 men walking along a narrow path. So even though it shares something with the Crystal Cathedral in that it's a lot of glass and it's open, that the ethos behind it is really different, and it's a gorgeous little building. Use of local southern pine, oak, local fieldstone for the floor of the chapel. So an emphasis on fitting the place where the building exists. And that is related to the trend and concern about green building and the environment, but also, again, this light-filled space. Only this one, as I'm sure you can tell, is much more meditative than the Crystal Cathedral. So some buildings that respond, these are recent buildings, award-winning buildings that I wanted to show. Similar idea, openness to the environment. This just won a design award last year. It's a Universalist, Unitarian Universalist Church in Minnesota, Minneapolis suburb. And on 2 walls of the building, it's simply open to the outside. So there's this desire to not separate, to not make architecture a barrier between nature and culture inside. Another wonderful award-winning building is this Bigelow Chapel at United Theological Seminary in New Brighton, Minnesota. Has anybody seen this? I heard a talk by the architect, but I haven't actually visited the building. And again, smaller, more meditative space. This was a $3 million building. I think it involved the small sanctuary and a narthex and a restroom, so not a huge complex. But the architect was faced with this dilemma of wanting to create, it's a fairly modernist, rectilinear, modern building campus, and she wanted to create a worshipful, gentle, comforting place. And I think the fact that she was a woman affects this. I shouldn't make a claim like that, but in hearing her talk about it, she was definitely thinking in terms of, well, she was paired with an architect who did this Catholic block concrete building down in Louisiana, and his seems so kind of harsh and aggressive, and this was much more. I was thinking about this building when Fred was talking about looming, because this building definitely has that kind of feel. So what she decided to do was create a building that was sensitive on the outside to the architecture of the campus. So it's stone and concrete, and it's rectilinear, and it blends in very nicely with the rest of the campus, but then create this interior, and you can see, so here's the rough outline of the building. And she has this interior shape that's made from a very thin maple veneer, and it's a maple that has a particular pattern to it called quilting. So it seems sort of billowy and soft, almost like a fabric. And the wood apparently came from Europe somewhere and was milled in Indiana. So not local materials here, but that was it involved some invention and technology to get the wood to do that. But it's translucent. The wood panels are translucent, mm-hmm. So they emit a very warm, luscious kind of light into that space.
How many people does that?
No, 100 maybe. It's used for concerts and small services. And this is on that picture on the upper right. You see the altar there, so you get a sense of the dimension of the space. Not large, very intimate. And it would be hard to create a space like this for 1,000 people. It just doesn't work. This is a different kind of project. And this is here because I've been talking this week to several people who alerted me to this congregation. This is where Chris and Sonia worship in Minneapolis, and I think it was Carolyn or June who told me about this building too. This being open to the outside is something that's also affected some thoughtful urban congregations who are intentionally saying we are part of this city and we don't want to wall ourselves off. We want to express that we care about the city, we want people to be able to see into what we're doing, and we want to look out to what's happening out there. So this is a small Lutheran congregation that's not a beautiful neighborhood, but this glass wall that's open, and then behind these block windows behind the pulpit and altar that allow light through there, not so much that it would be that the light would make it hard to watch the pastor and the communion. So I haven't visited this, I would love to, but this is, so another trend, especially in urban churches, is looking at ways that we can rethink what it means to be an urban congregation, especially if the congregation at one time was 1,000 and now is 100. Do you leave the city? Is there a kind of flight? That happens sometimes. Or do we stay? And if we stay, I think there was a fire here, so they needed to rebuild. If we stay, what kind of architecture will communicate to our community what we're about and what our relationship should be to them.
This is the baptismal font in the foreground.
Oh yeah, that you were talking about. Yeah, that's like a river running through. Oh, that's wonderful.
That's Stephen Hall.
It's what?
It kind of looks like it a little bit.
Yeah.
It reminds me of St. Ignatius.
Say, I was thinking St. Ignatius, yeah.
Okay, another thing, this is another recent award-winning building, and it shows a lot of these things, natural materials, attention to light, and another thing that's happening in architecture is a recovery of tradition and an interest in vernacular forms. So this looks like an old New England church, a modern spin on that certainly, but there's something here that evokes the architectural tradition of that particular region in eastern Massachusetts. And that interest in the vernacular and parish history, in being rooted in place and recovering that, that's partly the emphasis of postmodernism and simply looking back for design sources that relate to your place. But there's also something theological about that well, and being concerned with the particular character of a congregation and how you can serve and how your building reflects that. There have been some wonderful restorations in the last two decades of urban spaces. There are just phenomenal 19th century urban churches that are in trouble. There's a group in Philadelphia called Partners for Sacred Places, which helps city churches deal with the problems of upkeep. But restorations are expensive on these buildings. This was a $20 million project over 20 years. And what happened in this case is just an interesting story, so I'll take a minute to tell it. This was the synagogue of the Eastern European Jews who came to the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the later 19th century. Thriving community center, it was a place where immigrants were acculturated to the new, their new place in New York. And then the neighborhood changed, and the Jewish population declined, and their people moved out of the city, and there weren't enough folks to keep this going. So sometime around the 1920s, it was simply closed up. Just not abandoned, but nobody could care for it or heat it, so it was closed up, wasn't used for services. And then sometime around 1980, a group of people decided, you know, we need to look at this, and opened it up, and it was like magic walking into the past, because the chandelier was still there, and it was all dusty, there were boards falling from the ceiling, but the potential was there to make this a really interesting restoration. And what's especially interesting here is that it's a museum and a worship space for a congregation. So on the Sabbath, they bring up the Torah, use the Bema, and it's a sacred space, and then they move all that stuff out, and it becomes a secular space, a museum during the week that has an educational staff and does allow the school groups and visitors to New York City. So interesting things being done in the world of preservation and churches as well, but that's a big job, costs a lot of money, and needs a lot of special expertise.
Are the seats numbered there? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I don't know if you were here yesterday when we were talking about pew rental, but you see that in other churches too, because you purchased a share in a pew for the year. That was a way of giving rather than, and I don't know exactly how it worked for Jews, but something similar, I imagine. Another recent restoration that shows this interest in histories in the past is St. Patrick's Church in Chicago, Irish immigrant church in 1854. About 1915, a Chicago artist decided that together with the congregation they would emphasize their Celtic heritage, and they did a new decorative program on the inside that had all sorts of Celtic motifs, and that's been recently restored as well. So here's a thriving Catholic parish in the city. This was the one institutional building that survived the Chicago fire. I'm not sure why, but it did, so it's a special building too. And there was a fire recently. I don't think it was this one. Does anyone know? One of these big churches just burned in Chicago.
It wasn't thriving all that long ago. It was down to like 12 members.
St. Patrick's?
Yeah.
Well, that must be, because this is...
I've been there. I mean, yeah, recently it's booming, and there's like a three-year wait list for weddings. But
yeah. No, they've had a period of real drop.
Yeah, it was like in the 70s during... Yes. And the demographic change.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. But now it's on the upswing, and that's why they've done this recent renovation.
Is that the old altar?
I don't know. I don't think so, because the old altar would have been on the
back.
You mean,
it's on
the back
wall. You can see it behind on the back wall.
Yeah, it's on the back.
It's still there.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Yeah.
You consider.
But that may date from 1915. I don't know.
I think it's the cathedral that recently had a fire.
That's right.
Yes.
I haven't seen this in a while. So. Okay, and in contrast with that, a new and very important but controversial building is the new cathedral in Los Angeles for the diocese there. And Rafael Moneo is a Spanish architect, very well-known architect, and the bishop there wanted to do something that was something that would serve the city. And one of the interesting things this space has is a 2.5-acre public plaza, and it's a complex that has not just the cathedral but a store and a restaurant and the rectory and a lot of other buildings. So this thinking of the European cities where the cathedral is in the middle and people come together and there's a lot of ordinary life happening in the sacred and the secular mix. But this has been it was a very expensive building, so there's controversy about that. But also many in California wanted to see something that picked up on the mission style architecture of old Spanish California. So something that had a red tile roof and looked Mediterranean in that sense. This does, I think, relate to that, but not in the same way. And there's this interesting mix of modern and not so modern inside. I haven't seen it yet. I hope to get out there soon. But maybe some of you have seen the new cathedral.
Yeah. I've worshipped there, and it really is. It to me, it worked. It was this incredible combination of ultra-modern, and yet it feels, and those tapestries are just stunning. And they're huge, they're enormous. And the tapestries really, in a sense, say what the architecture is. They're the saints from the past, but I don't know if you can kind of see, they're intermingled with folks from LA, mm-hmm. you know, and so it's this gathering of the saints, both past and present, in the building, and the light, the natural light inside is stunning. A lot of, by the way, Swanson's artwork is displayed, original artwork is downstairs, that we have all over Holden.
August
Swanson.
Yeah, I think I would like it, everything I've read about it and talked to people who've gone there. I think I was just talking to a guy from UC Berkeley who took some students down there who were very puzzled by the space. They found it a confusing mix of things, but that may be appropriate for an urban environment. I'm not sure how many this church seats. I think I looked at some.
It's right across
3,000.
The Disney Hall too, which is
Frank Gehry building. Yeah. I think that's all I had to say about that. This costs close to $200 million. So expensive. And that drew criticism because that's money that certainly could have been used for needy mission work in Los Angeles. And as the last building to look at, this is a very interesting church in Houston. I have not visited it. I watched a whole video on this building that was lent to me by one of my students. It's a Missouri Synod congregation outside of Houston, a fairly well-established congregation that needed to build a new church and decided they were going back to the source. They were going to build a German Lutheran church. And the church is modeled on a smaller version of this, which is the big church in Dresden that was destroyed in the Dresden bombing and went through really moving restoration where the community was involved, and they built it back from the rubble, and they even designed it so that you could tell the new stones from the old stones in the construction. But so this sense that this is true Lutheran architecture, it looks like this, and that idea came to this congregation in Houston, and the pastor went to Germany several times, visited this church, looked at other German Baroque churches from the 18th century. And this, interestingly, this doesn't really represent the architecture of the Lutheran church in Germany at this time. The reason that it was so ornate was it was southern Germany, and there was a struggle with the Catholic Church, and this was the big, powerful building that was supposed to speak to the big, powerful Catholic building. But this church was quite this congregation in Texas was quite taken by this building, and even to the extent of paying quite a bit of money to get wood carvings for the interior that were done by a workshop in Austria. So old techniques, old models for design. There's nothing contemporary here, even the structure of the interior, the organ. And if you look at this pulpit, some of you were here yesterday when I showed the altar from the Wittenberg Church, the Koranic altarpiece from the 1550s or so, and this is replicated on this pulpit at great expense. So here's a church that's thinking about the past in extremely literal ways and trying to connect with that past by building something that looks like the 16th or the 18th century, and I find it very interesting. And I think that's all I have to say, so I'll open it up to your comments and questions. If I can clarify anything, I'd love to hear what you're thinking.
I was wondering, in terms of trends, in churches I visited, including at St. Patrick's, and I also really like the Seattle U Chapel.
I have someone who was talking to me about that.
And what I've seen, I'm wondering how common it is, or if it should be one of our goals. In those places, they seem to involve either the architect or the designers in creating the altar, the seating. We saw in the LA Cathedral the tapestries were clearly designed for that space. Is that a luxury or should it be part of?
Do I think it's an unnecessary luxury, or is that what building committees generally think?
Or where is the mood in that?
I just find it, it's, oh, it creates such a greater space than...
Oh, I am...
The materials work together and...
This is just me talking, but I am very much in favor of congregations integrating arts within the space and thinking of the building not just as a shell that you throw whatever comes along your way into, but that there's a coherence to design, that the congregation's invested in art. But from my own experience on the building committee this year at my church, we had a budget and the architect had designed altar furnishings and picked pew design, and we had this lovely interior that was going to happen. And the bids came in above the budget, and $200,000 was cut, and it was all the furnishings. And I can see that this is killing the architect, because the, especially in modern buildings, it's, there's a coherence of design that's necessary for it to work. Otherwise, you get an image like that, one of my first slides of the interior of that new addition to Onalaska, that there is no coherence there. It's a useful space, but you don't walk in and say, wow, good design. And it relates to what we think about beauty as a church. Does beauty matter? It costs money. We could be spending that money in other ways that serve our communities, but how important is that? Is that a way to serve God? Is it the Catholics who are, there's a split in the Catholics right now between those who are kind of Vatican II types who like things like the new Los Angeles Cathedral and those who think that the worst thing that's happened to the Catholic Church in architecture in the last half century is listening to the Protestants like Ed Sovick, that he's like the villain. Nobody should have been reading his books if you were a Catholic. You should have been thinking about the Gothic like Pugin and his decay of the West when we got away from the medieval. And those folks are building pretty ornate interiors and designing them, and they say that what they use as defense is that we need to spend money on Jesus. You know, we need to be pouring the oil on Jesus as well. There's a part of loving God that's expressed in our giving our treasures to Him to create beautiful things in that way. And I think I'm somewhat sympathetic to that. But I don't know. That's just, I think it does get cut. It's, well, let's just build the shell. Once we have the shell, we'll just ask people for more money and they'll give a pew.
Build a gymnasium.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm thinking. You know, why don't we just throw up a pole barn if we're going to, you know, do that? But I should not be talking about a school here. Yeah.
If you want to show your congregation what it looks like to build a building that is just a functional building, you should go to the LDS built in about the 50s, maybe even late 40s. They built a big kitchen with a counter, and then they built a great big wooden floor, and the buildings are all either red or hideous yellowish brick, depending on whatever they happen to have. And then they have, so they have this big kitchen and then a big room with a hardwood floor and, you know, probably pull down baskets and stuff. And then they had a sanctuary all carpeted with, you know, just pews or chairs or whatever. And then on the other end, a raised area so that they could have people give their talks there and so on. It's all one great big long thing. So if your congregation get too big, you open up the doors and you seat them in the gym. And then you just turn around and walk into the gym when you want to have a big thing for dinners or anything like that. And the children were just always with the parents.
And it worked, and it wasn't expensive.
Well, it's just a big, long
There's a thing. Interesting program that Jehovah's Witness groups use when they create their kingdom halls. It's called a quick build. And they have a design that they use, and somebody comes in and pours a foundation, and then a team of people come in, and the women cook, and the men build, and within 72 hours, you have a building that's really good for what it needs to be. So there are ways of doing it. And you wonder if it's this intermediate area that gets dangerous when you're working with an architect and you're cutting corners. And my mother-in-law's congregation in Holland, Michigan, is about to build their first church, and they're using a ELCA denominational architect who's doing a great job for them, building a really nice, affordable building that looks like West Michigan, and it's smaller than what we're struggling with, but there are those resources. You mentioned kitchens. I should say kitchens are shrinking. That's another thing that's sort of obvious, but we don't have enormous parish dinners once a month anymore, and there's no need to have the industrial kitchens that were put in the 50s and 60s.
Unless you have a feeding program for the community.
And yes, you do, but those often have a different kind of kitchen that's attached to a first floor, in the new buildings anyway, what I've seen.
You have to have a commercial kitchen by law.
Yeah.
You have to have three sinks, blah, blah, blah.
That's
right. Health department's all over you.
Right, that's true.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, you know, you get some stuff that happens by happy accident. Christchurch Cathedral in Vancouver, the oldest public building in the city. But you walk in there, and when they built it in 1900 or so, it was all built by shipwrights. And so you walk in, and it's like walking in an upside down hull of a ship, which actually works well in a lot of, when you think about liturgy. It's all wood. It's all it's Gothic style, except that the columns are wood, the beams are all wood, and it's all either hot nailed or no nails at all.
And who else should build a nave except a shipwright?
Exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of them in Norway and Sweden. They're like that. They're big.
And they have a ship.
Yeah, they really have a ship. Yeah.
Yes, way in the back there.
I see these buildings being large, some of them, and I think right now we struggle with a number of churches, the maintenance of a building like this.
Yeah.
Especially heating and cooling, the boiler systems, and moving parts and lack thereof. And what kind of, beyond theology and beyond the planned architecture, the maintenance of buildings like this, or even smaller buildings, are you seeing trends of how churches care for the maintenance, the daily things, heating, cooling to be the major?
That's a good question. You mean on new buildings or older buildings,
well,
or both?
I guess a little of both, but you know, existing buildings that need to do something, and it seems that in my experience, there's a church in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, beautiful, beautiful downtown parish for many years, still could exist, but it's 80,000 right off the top just for heating and cooling.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually mostly heating and then the maintenance of that building, and that's a major part of their budget.
It's a fairly intractable problem for those big
Does this
city
design
churches.
Help, you know,
in more open area?
The main thing that helps in these newer buildings is better insulation, better seals on the building, and more efficient heating and cooling systems. And some older buildings, there was a picture in there of Westwood in St. Louis Park. I was talking to the facilities manager there a few years ago, and he had replaced his big central boiler with several separate ones that he could adjust according to what their needs were. And it was an investment. It was thousands and thousands of dollars for that congregation, but within a decade, they will have recovered what that cost. And in newer buildings, even if you can't afford the real LEED certified sort of buildings, there are panels that are insulated panels. Our new church will be, it's like a foam core and then fiberboard or plywood, I think, on either side. And they're just extremely well insulated. So those of you who live in new houses and have lived in old houses know that you can heat twice the space for the same amount of money if you have the new materials. But it's really hard. And some churches just decide to shut down the sanctuary, and if the congregations are smaller, to shut that down during the colder months.
Yeah.
And worship in a fellowship hall or somewhere else. It's interesting because clearly we have different ideas about what kind of comfort we need for worship, since those were just fine for people, 100 years ago. Yeah.
Can you just address a little bit the philosophies and trends between Narthex, Fellowship Hall, and Sanctuary?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Are they, I should declare that my background is Catholic, so I don't think Narthex was a new word.
Yeah, Narthex is not the same as the Fellowship Hall, which tended to be off to the side, but the Narthexes now are more and more working like Fellowship Halls. They're the central gathering spaces of a congregation. In visiting churches and newer churches, in the summer when I'm not teaching, I often run into VBS programs, for instance, largely happening in these big narthex spaces, but they're not sanctuaries. The place of worship is still in the sanctuary. But it's, the boundaries are pretty fuzzy when there's nothing that designates that space as such.
We're in a building program, and in our research, the trend is, at least in Midwest, to not even call it the narthex anymore. It's the gathering.
Gathering space, yeah, that's true. And
how is it distinct, or why is it not, like, looked at the classroom, the comment you made was, well, it was only an hour a day in the Sunday school rooms. Mm-hmm. So what's the theology or thinking about fellowship versus narthex, where you gather and you go off and do things?
Narthex is really just the entryway.
Is it still relevant?
But it has to be more than that to justify. I think it's a stewardship question, like you were saying, Gretchen. But to me, it's the theology of literally of gathering and assembling people, and then from this place, then you can go this way to worship, or this way to education, or this way to meeting space. But gathering is literally, and that's the very visible space in a lot of buildings to the outside. So that parking lot and everything just moves into this very welcoming place where often these little cafe type, you know, things with even espresso or whatever, it's the place where people gather and can, in a very non-threatening way, be met by other folks before going on to other.
And then in that case, what happens in the fellowship hall that's distinct from that?
Those aren't, the languages, I'm using a lot of, I use the word narthex because that's what many of you are familiar, but they're not called that anymore in new buildings. It's the gathering space or the welcoming space. And fellowship hall is a word that was often used for old church basements that had a stage on one side and a kitchen on one side and kind of open auditorium space.
You might have the wedding reception there or the...
Yeah.
So is that no longer being built as such? Or what's the trend about fellowship halls?
Multi-use.
Yeah, one thing that I've seen is churches using gyms as fellowship halls. So building something that you can has a basketball floor, but then you can lay another surface on and use for congregational dinners and that sort of thing. So there's this, it's an interesting time because a lot of these spaces are being rethought. One more comment. I think I'm running out.
I had a question, and that was I wondered if any of the people out in the just outside of the cities have thought about recycling those buildings which are inside the cities. We go to a downtown church. It's wonderful. It's huge. It needs so many people. If we had 300 people in the congregation like they did when they built the church, and it's 40 years old, the church is, but the Wells Hall was built in 1929, and we almost sold it. But when we talked about it long enough, we finally decided that if our ancestors could build that building in 1929, who are we to give it away? And so we voted unanimously to keep it. And we're struggling like crazy to rent it out, this big hall with a wooden floor. They do contra dancing in there every other Saturday night, and we rent it out, and we painted it all, we fixed it all up, and it's just beautiful. It's got a big stage, and it's wonderful. And the people talk about, oh, they're out there somewhere, they're trying to figure out how they can build a building and put $300,000 worth of furnishings in it. Come on down.
Well, that's a great comment, and I'll just close with this. You can see how these buildings become for congregations. They're blessings, but they can also become an albatross. And we need to recognize that demographics change. And we get so attached to these buildings. Your typical church history, parish history, written for the 50th or the 75th anniversary, will focus on two things: the tenure of pastors and the lives of buildings. Yep. And it's a way that you mark the passage of time in a congregation, and so they're important. And I will leave you with that. Thank you.